We are up to the 13th in an ongoing series on the 13 Ikrim. Okay, the 13th of 13. But this is not the last share, I hate to tell you that. I'm glad to tell you that. Depending on your perspective, we're up to the 7th Ikar, which means that by the time we get to 13, the 13th Ikar, then we'll probably be well into Shia 24 or 25, but we'll get there when we get there. Bezrat Hashem. This is part 2 of the 7th Ikar. Last week we started this, and I just want to recap for those of you who weren't here or don't remember what we discussed actually 2 weeks ago when we did the first part. The Rambam, having told us in the 6th Ikar about prophecy and explained how prophecy works and how a prophet connects with HaKadosh Baruch Hu through his imaginative faculty, connects with the active intellect, with the lowest level of emanation from this divine overflowing spring. He then talks in the 7th Ikar about how Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy was completely different from that. Not just more so, but we saw last time, and I brought you again this source in context here this time, is that the only thing Moshe Rabbeinu has in common with every other Navi is that we call them both Nevi'im. But really, the word Navi is just their homonym. It just means the same thing, it just spelled the same and pronounced the same, but it has a completely different meaning. In other words, Moshe Rabbeinu's Nevuah was not just greater than every other Navi, but was completely different. He outlined in the last week's share, we saw in the 7th Ikar, he outlines four areas in which Moshe Rabbeinu's Nevuah was different from other people's Nevuah. He talks about the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu had absolute clarity, he didn't see through visions, he was completely awake and in charge of his faculty, he wasn't afraid, he wasn't collapsing, he was completely cool, calm, and in charge of his own mind. And the conclusion that we half came to was that Moshe Rabbeinu basically, and the Rambam stresses, is that the thing that we have in common with all of these distinctions between Moshe and other Nevi'im is that Moshe's Nevuah was pure intellect. Pure and unadulterated intellect, whereas every other Navi was seeing things not through not just an intellectual capacity, but also through an imaginative capacity. That's why it comes out in visions and images. Just look for a second on page 2. These are two sources that we saw last time, but I want to just use them to update our understanding and refresh our memory. I brought you just a one-liner from the Mori Nevuchim here in source number 4. It says, Moshe did not receive prophetic inspiration through the medium of the imaginative faculty, but directly through the intellect. That's what we said. And the Abar Benel, in his commentary elsewhere, in the little bit before that, says, as following number 5, it says, in the guide, which is the Mori Nevuchim, the Rambam did not mention the four distinctive features of Moshe's prophecy stated in the Mishnah Torah, because all four points arise from a single concept found in the guide. The Moshe's prophecy did not involve the imaginative faculty. It is the imaginative faculty that caused the cessation of the other prophets' senses. They collapsed, they could no longer function, such that they could prophesy only when dreaming, in a vision. And it caused their prophetic message to be enshrouded in metaphor and allegory. Likewise, the fear that they experienced came from the reaction of the imagination when receiving the prophetic apprehension, which is frightening. And the need to involve their imaginative faculty led to the requirements of preparation for each prophetic event. And we saw they're the basic four things. Moshe was online 24/7. He didn't get frightened. He was he didn't see in visions, and he saw with absolute. He was in charge of his faculties, and he saw with absolute clarity. Thus, by mentioning this one fundamental concept in the guide, the Rambam effectively included the four distinctions which are written in the Mishnah Torah. Fine. That's all revision. That brings us up to speed, if you like, with where we left off last week. I want to pick up with a fascinating question. Look here in number 1. I left you with this question last week. The Rambam writes at the end of the, or in the middle really, of the 7th Ikar, just before he goes into the four distinctions that we've just discussed between Moshe and other prophets. He says, Lefikach, he says, I'm not going to go into depth and detail about Moshe's prophecy now, because it'll take too long, it'll be hundreds of pages, it's too deep, there's too much information, I'm only giving you an outline. And he says, Lefikach, anichehu lemekoimam, I'll leave it for another place. Im besefer perish adroshes, asher yadati lechavram. Because either I'm going to write it up in a book about the drashot, a book about how the Torah learns, how the halacha and the midrashim and how everything is learnt out from the psukim. I want to write a book about that, he says. Or the Sefer HaNevuah, or I'm going to include it in the book about prophecy, Shechiloisiboy, which I've already begun work on. He writes this when he's quite young. Or the Sefer Perish Eloi Yisodas, or I'm going to write a more detailed book about the Ikrim. So don't worry, he says, because one day I'm going to write you a whole book that deals with Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy. Which is very nice, something to look forward to. The Rambam wrote two other major things after he finished the Ikrim, which was in the commentary on the Mishnah. He wrote the Mishnah Torah, which is a halachic work, where he codifies the entire Torah Shabbat Al-Peh. And he wrote the Morin Nevuchim, which is his philosophical work, the Guide to the Perplexed. He wrote lots of smaller things as well. He wrote letters to different people, of some of which are extremely important. He wrote lots of medical works. He wrote treatises on all sorts of interesting things, pharmacology and hemorrhoids and all the most unusual things you could possibly imagine. He wrote lots of stuff. But you can go through his entire corpus, and there doesn't seem to be a book about Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy. It certainly doesn't seem to be the Mishnah Torah, which is the Halacha book. So you're going to tell me, okay, so it's the Morin Nevuchim, right? It must be the Morin Nevuchim. If ever there was a book that was a candidate, must be the Morin Nevuchim. So let me show you what he writes in the Morin Nevuchim. Number two. I have already described the four points in which the prophecy of Moses, our teacher, was distinguished from that of other prophets. So I've already done that. In books accessible to everyone. In the commentary on the Mishnah. In the Mishnah Torah, the commentary on the Mishnah is where he wrote the Ikrim. The Mishnah Torah, he went through again the difference between Moshe and other prophets. I need not repeat the subject here, nor is it included in the theme of this work. That's not looking too good. For I must tell you that whatever I say here of prophecy, in other words, whenever I talk about prophecy in the Morin Nevuchim, he says, I refer exclusively to the form of prophecy of prophets before and after Moses. But as to the prophecy of Moshe, I will not discuss it in this work with one single word. He seems to be not only not discussing it, but going out of his way to tell you that he's not going to discuss it. Whether directly or indirectly. Because in my opinion, the term prophet is applied to Moses and other men only in the both terms of hominins, as I told you before. Moshe's got nothing to do with any other prophecy, and I'm talking about other prophecy here. Don't expect me to talk about Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy. Which seems to be a very, he's protesting, I'm not going to discuss it, etc. Which even deepens our question even more. No, so where was it? Where is it? Where am I going to find it?
Because Rambam used to have his notes before his book.
Okay, well, you could say that. The problem with that is that he went back over the Yugil Ikrim at the end of his life. We see he puts things in, he cross-refers. He could have written in a line after this saying, but I never wrote them. Okay, I didn't get around to it yet. Or he could have deleted this line that I'm going to write a book about it. I mean, to leave the line in, I'm going to write a book, when he says I'm not going to write a book. It's funny, no? There's something not quite right here. There's something smells a bit strange. And of course, you well know that the Rambam writes at the beginning of the Morin Nevuchim, in his introduction, that I'm going to say things in my book, remember this?
Yeah.
That are the opposite of the truth, in order to throw you off the scent so that you won't really understand it. So only the people who really understand it will understand it. This is the esoteric understanding of the Rambam. The Rambam says that at the beginning. He says all intelligent books are written like this. He speculates that the Tanakh is also written like this. To say things to kind of throw off the scent people who are not really serious. So I wonder whether we're going to be able to find that actually, even though the Rambam protests so much, methinks the lady doth protest too much. And therefore, we'll see if we can find something else here. Now, what is the Morin Nevuchim all about? Why did he write it? Let's have a look at the introduction, because the Rambam very usefully wrote an introduction to the Morin Nevuchim where he explains his purpose in writing the book. Why didn't someone read number three, save my ailing voice? Who's going to read number three? Katie, you want to read?
Yeah.
Fine. So this is from the introduction to the Morin Nevuchim.
The object of this
treatise, book,
is to enlighten a religious man who has been trained to believe in the truth of our holy law. who conscientiously fulfills his moral and religious duties, at the same time has been successful in his philosophical studies.
So my purpose here is enlightenment. This book is there to bring enlightenment, to light up your life, to clarify your problems. That's why it's called Moreh Nevuchim, the guide to those who are perplexed, confused. Nevuchim means they're confused, they're groping around in the dark. Paro describes the Jewish people when they're leaving Egypt and they turn away from their journey out, which of course we know why they did that, but he doesn't know why they did that. He says, Nevuchim hei mabibar, they're all confused in the desert. So this book is to clarify your life. Carry on.
Do not imagine that these most difficult problems can be thoroughly understood by any one of us. This is not the case. At times, the truth shines so brilliantly that we perceive it as clear as day. Our nature and habit then draw a veil over our perception, and we return to a darkness almost as dense as before. We are like those who, though beholding frequent flashes of lightning, will find themselves in the thickest darkness of the light.
So he's going to introduce a beautiful metaphor, which is you're tramping through a field in a thunderstorm in the middle of the night, trying to find some farmhouse or whatever. I'm embellishing a little bit. And it's pitch black and it's pouring with rain and you can't see where you're going. But every now and then there's a flash of lightning which lights up. You know how bright lightning is. Every blade of grass for a millisecond is completely in relief. And then it's pitch black again. He says, and that's the story of our lives.
On some, the lightning flashes in rapid succession. And they seem to be in continuous light. And their night is as clear as the day.
Oh, so some people have the enlightenment already on an almost constant basis. The light's flashing so that they see their whole life is lit up. And they're the people, if you like, who are fully enlightened already. Carry on.
This is the degree of prophetic excellence attained by Moses, the greatest of prophets, to whom God said, "But as for you, stand here by me, and of whom it is written, the skin of his face shone."
Oh, so he has just mentioned something important about Moshe Rabbeinu, which is Moshe Rabbeinu's enlightenment was the perfect embodiment of what enlightenment could be. Okay, carry on.
Some perceive the prophetic flash as long intervals. This is the degree of most prophets.
A flash here, a flash there, but not real clarity.
For others, a flash of lightning is perceived only once during the whole night. This is the case with those of whom we are informed. They prophesied and did not prophesy again.
Okay, so prophesy again. So we have these flashes of life, of light in life, and the rest of life we're groping around in the dark. And that applies to all of us. We're all trying to orientate ourselves with these moments of clarity and inspiration, and they help us to redirect and recalibrate, and then we're kind of walking in the dark again. That's the story of the human condition. By the way, Rav Hirsch, when he writes in his 19 letters to his student, trying to inspire him to be connected with Judaism, he says very beautifully and very honestly, the 19 letters are a book which is created as if it's written to a student asking questions as to why he's religious. Rav Hirsch writes to this made-up student, as he wrote in one of his letters, I'm glad that you want to come to me for guidance and questions, and I'd be delighted to help you. And he has books and books to help him. He says, but you must realize that I'm also groping in the dark. I'm also trying to work it out. I'm also left sometimes without clear answers. And I think that there's a bit of a tendency these days for people, especially teachers, to feel a sense of pressure that they have to have all the answers and all the clarity. And if they can't answer anything, or if there's anything left as a question, oy vey, the students aren't going to be from anymore, and what can I do? That's never been a Jewish way. We're always groping around in the dark to some degree or other. Only Moshe Rabbeinu is fully lit up. Now, first thing you see from here is that whatever this book is about, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't need it. This book is to supply that which Moshe Rabbeinu did not have any lack of. That's what he just said in the introduction. That the enlightenment in this book is there to help us when we're groping in the dark, and Moshe was not groping in the dark. Fine, very nice. So that's the first thing I want to mention. Now go to source number 6. What does it mean when we think? Because we did 4 and 5. Did I do 3?
Yeah.
Yeah, we just did 3. Fine. Yeah, we just did 3 now. Let's look at number 6. What does it mean when we think? What does it mean to think? So we looked at this briefly in the first Ikka, but some of you weren't here and some of you may have forgotten. So let's have a look at this source about what it means for a human being to think. Now, let's go. Katie, why don't you read this too?
God is an intellect in
actu, means he's constantly active.
And that there is absolutely no potentiality in him.
Meaning you can't turn around and say, well, God is currently having a break, but soon he'll be back thinking again. There's nothing potential that may happen. It's all in full flow all the time.
Such that he does not sometimes think and sometimes not think, but is always an intellect in action. It follows necessarily that he and the same
thought
are one thing, which is his essence.
Oh, so that's a very interesting thing. So the first thing that Rambam has said is that God, because God is not divided into different parts, so God is what not only the thinker, but the process of thinking and the thing which is thought itself. And we'll come back to this again when we do when we do the 10th and 11th Ikrim, Imiyat Hashem, when we look at the stira, the contradiction between God's knowledge and our freedom of choice, which is a classic, which the Rambam deals with. And he comes back to this response when he says, if you think you know what God's thinking is, then you can think again. Okay? Or maybe try to think again, because you won't be able to work it out. But he says, God is the thinker, the thought, and the process. But not only that, but this is his essence. Which is very interesting, because the Rambam told us we can't really say anything about what God's essence is. But this seems to be an exception. That we can say. That God is a process of thought. That's what God is. Okay? Now carry on.
Why does he say that?
Why does he
why does thought we're allowed to use this to say that we have an definition?
Why does he allow himself the liberty of saying that this you can say about God? Because I'm not 100% sure. I'm not 100% sure. But I think the answer is that any other thing that you're describing is more of a physical thing. Whereas the process of thinking in the world of the Rambam and others as well is an entirely spiritual thing. There is nothing physical that's happening in thinking. If you say God is great, God is powerful, God is this, God is that, you're somehow connecting some physicality or externality with God. But thinking is an entirely internal and spiritual act. Okay? Descartes, who came of course later than the Rambam, understood, and of course not everyone after him understood the same way, that the body was made of material matter, but the mind was made of an immaterial matter, which is completely separate and distinct from the body. So the Rambam is saying, to say that God thinks is not saying anything in any sense physical about God. Carry on.
Moreover, the act of thinking is in itself the intellect, which is his essence.
Fine, carry on.
It is accordingly also clear that this is not true for the Creator only, but also for every intellect. Thus enough to the intellectualizing subject, the intellect and the intellectually recognized object are one and the same thing, whenever we have an intellect in action. We, however, pass intellectually from potentiality to actuality only from time to time.
Oh, so here he says something remarkable, which is the way you think when you're really thinking, and the way God thinks, when God's always thinking, is the same. The difference between us and God is that we just turn off a lot. Some people never think. We sleep, and we take our mind off things, and we, you know, go out to work and do other stuff which is humdrum and boring and things like that. And we have to do what we have to do. We have to get our tires fixed and our punctures mended and all that stuff. But when we actually sit and think, the thought process is the same thing that's going on as the divine essence. Which means, this is, at the end of the day, the Tzelem Elokim. Okay. The Tzelem Elokim, the thing about us, everybody agrees, and the Chumash says that there is something about us which is divine. What is it? It's not some kind of neshama inside us. Okay. It is the ability, says the Rambam, for us to actually think intellectually. That is what God is constantly, and that is what we are. Of course, God's level of intellectualization is way beyond anything we can really understand, but on some level we're doing the same thing when we actually actively think. Yes?
Can you please define intellectually? Because it seems like there's varying degrees of thinking.
Meaning what?
So, like, if you're just standing out the window, even if you're just looking at the tree, you're really thinking, like, oh, it's a tree, you know? But if you're like, thinking like, oh, what is the wrong one saying? There's different kinds of thinking.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer as to draw a line that I can accurately say I was taught that this is the line and this is beyond the line. I think when a person is considering the meaning of things or the analysis of things which relate to reality, on some level, it doesn't have to be philosophy or theology or contemplating the meaning of God. That's called thinking. When a person learns Torah, that's called thinking. When a person davens and understands the words, That's called thinking. When a person stares out of the window and looks at the trees, I don't know if that's called thinking, because it depends on what you're thinking. If you're just kind of tuning out and saying, that's a nice tree, maybe that's not thinking. But if you're actively saying, that's so interesting, look at that tree, look at the way it works, that, what does that tell me about trees and life and you know, things like that. Maybe that you cross the line into active thinking. I don't know. I'm not going to speculate, because I'm not going to tell you what I think the Rambam means if I don't have any Masorah for that.
Just a quick follow-up. But God thinks about more than one thing at a time, more limited in how.
Correct.
Think about
God is able to think without on an infinite level.
Right.
Which is also, but on a certain level, when you are thinking, that thinking itself has a certain infinity to it, because it's a non-physical thing. It's a very interesting question, even today, even 900 years after the Rambam. What is consciousness? We really don't have an answer to that question. Even at the cutting edge of neuroscience, we can explain the brain, but we can't explain the mind. We can talk about how we think that people's minds react to different things, but understanding why we perceive ourselves as ourselves and how we think about it is a very difficult thing to pin down. And as far as I'm aware, I'm not a neuroscientist, but I think that that is, from what I've read and I've seen and I've spoken to people, that is where we're holding, and maybe where we always will be holding. Yes?
What Hebrew word is used for thinking?
Well, you see, the thing is, he doesn't use a Hebrew word. He uses an Arabic word. So the Hebrew word that he uses is not really relevant. If we look in Rabbi Shilat's Hebrew translation, which I don't have with me, which I didn't bring with me, not Rabbi Shilat's, Professor Schwartz, Michael Schwartz, which is probably the best Hebrew translation, straight from the Arabic modern translation, we can look at what words he uses. I'm not sure. I can't remember exactly what word he uses here. I don't know. I'm not going to guess. I'll bring it in, please God, next time, and we can have a look at the word he uses. But that's going to be a translation as well.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
Fine. Let's go on. Now, so thinking is obviously very important and very godly. Let's go back to Moshe Rabbeinu. Look at number 7. Let me bring you two sources, 7 and 8, and we'll see what we can do about this. Why did we need Moshe to give the Torah? Why couldn't somebody else give the Torah? So the Rambam addresses this here in source number 7. He says like this. We have given the definition of prophecy, stated its true characteristics, and shown that the prophecy of Moses, our teacher, was distinguished from that of all the prophets. We will now explain that this distinction alone qualified him for the office of proclaiming the law, a mission without parallel in history from Adam to Moses or amongst prophets who came after him. It is a principle of our faith, is an ikkah, that there will never be revealed another law. That's the ninth ikkah. We'll get to it when we get to it. Consequently, we hold that there has never been, nor will there ever be, any other divine law but that of Moshe Rabbeinu. So, we needed Moshe's nevuah to reveal to us the Torah. The Torah could never have been given to us without Moshe's nevuah. Why? And since there's no Moshe, there's no more Torah. It is clear that the law is normal in this sense, for it contains, quote, just statutes and judgments. It brings a posuk from Devarim. Okay? And just here is identical with balanced. The way he describes, let me just get a Chumash Devarim. Second. Find a Devarim somewhere. Okay. He says like this, the posuk uses the expression, excuse me. The pasuk uses the expression chukim umishpatim tzadikim. Tzadik. The laws of the Torah are tzadikim. Obviously, it doesn't mean tzadikim like we think a tzadik is this or that. What does it mean they're tzadikim? He says they're balanced. They are in equilibrium. That's what a tzadik is. A tzaddik is someone who doesn't go too far in one direction, too far in another direction. He does exactly the right thing. The statutes of the laws do not impose burdens or excesses, as are implied in the service of a hermit or a pilgrim. In other words, you don't have to go live in a cave, and we don't suggest you do. But on the other hand, they're not so deficient as to lead to gluttony or lewdness. In other words, they don't just leave it to you and say, be a nice person, you know, but that's about all the guidance we give you. And what you end up doing, of course, is exactly what you want to do on the weekend, not what you should do. So the Torah is in between there. or to prevent the religious laws of the heathen nations do, etc. The development of a man's moral and intellectual faculty. No, this terror won't hold you back. It'll give you just enough in order to be in balance and to develop yourself, but it'll stop you from going over the edge. We intend to discuss in this treatise the reasons of the commandments, because he says you need to understand not just what the Torah wants you to do, but why the Torah wants you to do it. That's what it means, chukim mishpatim tzadikim, that they make sense. They are rational on some level. There are reasons for them. And we shall then show, as far as necessary, the justice and wisdom of the Torah, on account of which it says, the Torah of God is perfect, Torah Hashem Tanima, okay, refreshes the heart. The Rambam says a very interesting thing. You needed Moshe Rabbeinu to be able to give the Torah, and the Torah could never be given by anyone other than Moshe Rabbeinu. Why? Because the Torah makes sense. Because the Torah is balanced. Because the Torah has reasons. Because the Torah gives you mitzvahs which will give you guidance in different areas of life. And the Rambam, by the way, in the Mora Nebuchim, spends an incredible amount of time in the third section dedicated to ta'amei ha-mitzvot. Maybe we'll have a discussion about that at some stage in another class. The idea that the Torah is not just a bunch of chukim, of just completely undiscernible and inscrutable rules. I know a lot of people today tend to feel that, like, we don't know what anything means. Everything's a chuk. The Rambam goes out of his way, as do others. Rasadi Gon talks about this, to say, no, every mitzvah, you won't get to the bottom of it completely, because of course it's infinite, comes from Hashem, but that doesn't mean that you can't have a good understanding, and therefore he wants to explain, why do we keep kosher? Why do we wear shabbos? Why do we keep shabbos? Why do we not do avodah zarah? Not just don't do it, but why? So that's what the Torah is, and for that we need Moshe Rabbeinu. Yes?
How can Moshe have had free will if he was going to start this for the
Why? Why are the two things are incompatible?
Shouldn't he need to have done certain things in order to get to where God needed him to be?
Done what kind of things? Personal and moral development?
Like merit. Yeah. Like, for sure, like, he could, like, so he was just like he was, I think maybe this is what you're saying, that, like, why would he automatically assume that he's going to get to the point where he could give the Torah?
Oh, we'll talk about that in a minute. I think I know what you're saying. When we get to source 11,
okay.
Remind me again to talk about that. We'll get there. So source number 7 is basically saying the Torah makes sense. That's why it has to be given through Moshe Rabbeinu. It couldn't be given through anybody else. I'm going to put all these together in a minute.
We'll see.
In number 8, he talks about how the world was created. He talks about creation, not Torah. So like this. Although we believe that God created the universe from nothing, although we talked about that in the fourth thicker, it's not so simple. Most of our wise and learned men believe that the creation was not the exclusive result of his will. Rather, his wisdom, which we are unable to comprehend, made the actual existence of the universe necessary. In other words, God just didn't make the world randomly. The world was made according to certain principles. There was a wisdom, there was a chokhmah in the way the world was created. It is not unreasonable to assume that the works of God, their existence and preceding non-existence, are the result of his wisdom. But we are unable to understand many of the ways of his wisdom and his works. Fine. So the world was created, and there are underlying reasons for this verse, there are underlying reasons for this cup being this cup. And this table being this table. It's not just that God said it has to be that way. Who are we to ever understand that? We won't fully understand that. But there are reasons. There's a system. And then he says a fascinating thing. And he says, on this principle, the whole of Torah Moshe is based. So again, he starts talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. What's this got to do with Moshe Rabbeinu? This is about creation. This is not about Torah. It begins with a principle. And God saw that all he'd made, and behold, it was very good. And it ends with a principle. The rock perfected his work. Again, the Rambam is saying that creation itself makes sense. To make sense, you need Moshe Rabbeinu. That's why the Torah of Moshe has to be given by Moshe, because things have to make sense. And finally, in number 9, he ends the Mora Nebuchim. How does he end the Mora Nebuchim? We saw how he begins it with his introduction. And he talks about enlightenment and the flashing lightning and Moshe Rabbeinu having constant lightning. He ends it and he says the following. They say of Moshe, he ends it, you know, for a book that's not meant to be talking about Moshe, talks an awful lot about Moshe. Okay, they say of Moshe, our teacher, that he was the father, like he was the master, in knowledge of the law, in Torah, in wisdom, in chokhmah, in nevuah, in prophecy. The perfection of which a man can truly glory is attained by him when he is acquired, as far as it's possible for a man, knowledge of God, knowledge of providence, the manner in which it influences creatures, creation, production of continued existence. Having acquired this knowledge, he will then be determined always to seek chesed, judgment, righteousness, and imitate the ways of God. Now, he ends the Moreh Nevuchim talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, he starts the Moreh Nevuchim talking about Moshe Rabbeinu. He spends half the time of the Moreh Nevuchim talking about the fact that Torah makes sense, that's why it comes from Moshe. Creation makes sense, that's why it's based on Torah's Moshe. And he ends the Moreh Nevuchim saying, the ultimate goal of everything is to be like Moshe Rabbeinu, okay, which is to know God fully and to understand creation, to understand Torah. Then the Moreh Nevuchim starts with Moshe, it talks about Moshe, and it ends with Moshe. Do you know why he's not going to talk specifically about the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu in the Moreh Nevuchim? And why he says not one single word of the Moreh Nevuchim will be about Moshe Rabbeinu? That's because the entire Moreh Nevuchim is the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu. The entire Moreh Nevuchim, I don't mean the Moreh Rabbeinu said the Moreh Nevuchim. I heard this from my teacher, Rabbi Tribbetz. It's an amazing insight. Which is the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu means the Ikka. Why is it an Ikka? It's got nothing to do with Torah Min HaShamayim. Torah Min HaShamayim is number 8. We'll see in a minute. Torah Min HaShamayim works on a different principle. Torah Min HaShamayim is also Moshe Rabbeinu, but a different kind of Moshe Rabbeinu. We'll see in a minute. The seventh Ikka is to understand that there is such a thing in the human mind as the process of thought, and in the process of thought, we mirror the divine. We, like we said, God thinks actually. When we think in action, we also are like God. That process of thought can reveal emes. It can reveal the truth about Torah, the truth about creation. The process of intellectualizing and bringing enlightenment is Nevuas Moshe Rabbeinu, i.e. the power of the human intellect. The most supreme example of that, whoever lived and will ever live, is Moshe Rabbeinu. But insofar as each one of us is able to do that, we also connect in with this idea of the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu. And therefore the purpose of the Moreh Nevuchim is to explain, the whole book is there to explain to people, this is what Moshe Rabbeinu is all about, this is what the Nevuah is all about. That you too can understand Judaism. That you too can have the lightning flashing for you more than you think it will. And Moshe had the lightning flashing all the time, so you'll have it flashing a bit more when you finish the book than when you started the book. That's the whole book. So it's not telling you about Moshe as such. It's telling you about the process of the human brain, which is really fundamental. I'll tell you why it's fundamental. Because the Rambam Lushitaso, the Rambam takes the view in oral law that almost all of the oral law, we learned this when we learned our oral law class, but again I'll go over it, almost all of Torah Shebaal Peh is produced by human beings. It's not just given at Har Sinai in its entirety and passed down. Remember the three columns? How could you forget? Column number 1, Halacha L'Moshe Nisinai. Okay, that's given on Sinai. But the vast majority of the Torah is column number 2, drashas, which are worked out from the Pesukim by the rabbis, using the human brain, creating the Halacha. And column number 3, which is, if you don't know what I'm talking about with these columns, then you won't know what I'm talking about. But it's the divisions of Torah. Column 3 was rabbinic law, which is created entirely by the rabbis. So the Rambam is telling me in Ikka number 7, how does Torah work? The answer is, there is one important part of Torah that works by the human brain. It is based on something which was given to by God directly, but this is the human brain. This is why it says the Moshe Rabbeinu sees through an aspect clarity and the hearer through a clear glass. That's the power of the human intellect. It's an incredible chiddush. It's telling you that you can't understand Judaism without understanding the power of the human brain. Yeah.
So then, to make sure I understand this, so then, Moreh Nevuchim, that's like the process of thinking.
Yes.
Which is the process of Moshe's
instructions. Correct.
Okay. Whoa.
Moreh Nevuchim is the process of thought. And that's why he says Torah Moshe is the reasons for the mitzvahs. That's why he says Torah Moshe is the reason for creation. And of course you're never going to understand fully, and certainly not as fully as Moshe Rabbeinu. Even Moshe Rabbeinu didn't understand fully, because he reached the ultimate level that a human being can reach, but at the end of the day was only mortal. That's why God turns around to him when he says, when Moshe says, show me your essence, and God says to him, you can't understand my essence because you are alive. No man, no person that lives can understand my lessons. But you've reached the highest possible level. Now, I'll answer your question. Look at source number 11. Source number 11 is the Rambam in Shmona Perachim. The Rambam wrote an introduction to the Pirkei Avos, to his commentary on Pirkei Avos, and he says like this: HaPerek HaShvi b'mechitzes v'inyanam. What barriers? What does it mean barriers? So he says Hakavanah b'zeh ha'inyan. Masha Omer Lecha. What I'm trying to tell you is as follows: Hushanu kvar bi'arnu b'perek hasheni, where he refers back to the second of the Shmona Perachim. Ki hamalos, the qualities, positive qualities in human life. Mehen malas sichlis, some of them are intellectual qualities. Or mehen malas midos, and some of them are ethical qualities. Mekain hapachisuyos, and similarly the opposite of qualities. I don't know what the English word is.
Defects.
Okay, let's say defects. Mehen chuzuyos sichlis, some of them are intellectual defects. Kesichlut, like idiocy. Okay, tipshut. And another word for idiocy, you know, like foolishness, okay? Kshia havana, and people who are just dim, you know? Okay, we're not blaming people, but some people just don't, you know, you say it 20 times and they just say, you know, they don't get it, okay? Umehem chizyos midas, and some of them are ethical defects. Kuroda taiva, people who are held back because they have too much
desire,
personal drive, whether it's physical, sexual, whatever. Hagaiva, arrogance. Hakas, anger, which stops people from developing. Hakina, jealousy. Ha'azus, cruelty. Avat hamomen, materialism. Umashe domenahem, and all these things. And there's lots of those. There's lots of ethical things that hold people back. And these defects, whether they be intellectual or physical or ethical, heima machitzas, these are the barriers. These are the things that separate us and block us up from God. Kind of feel like a musa, very important musa. The Amah Hanavi, okay, the Be'ezek, ki im avonaisechem hayom avdilim beinechem levein elokechem. He quotes the Navi that says that it's your averas that are separating you from God. Yom, as if to say, ki chatanu, the our sins. Okay, the hein elu haras, these are the evils that we do. Kamosh is chana, as we've just said. Hein amachitza shem avdilos beinenu ubein hayitala. These are the things that separate us from God. Now he's going to talk about Moshe. Ukaasha yada Moshe Rabbeinu knew full well. Shaloi nishara loy machitza shaloi kara. There was no machitza left that he hadn't torn down. He tore all the machitzas down. Ushikfar nishlemu boy malas hamidus. He achieved all of the levels of ethical perfection, kula, the hamalas asichlis kulam, and all of the levels of intellectual perfection. Then, when he got to the top of the ladder, bikesh lahasik Hashem ala mitas metziusa. Then he said, "Now God, show me who you are." Because there's nothing left. There's nothing. There's no separation. The amar, and he says to God, "Hareini nais kvoidecha. Show me your essence. Show me your glory." What God showed him is she'i efshaloi. It's not possible for him, Zeh. It is not possible. But he yosa seichel matzui l'chomer. As long as his intellect stays connected on some way to his guf, to his body. Ritzon elam, what I mean by this is, ba'ashe hu adam, he's a human being. But hu amro, and that's what it means when it says, ki lo yireni ha'adam l'chan. A living human cannot really see me. V'hinei loy nishar abeinoy abein hasagas Hashem ala mitzas metziusoy ala mechitza achas v'hira. One fine, clear mechitza was left. One see-through, you know, it's called the ultimate, this is the ultimate glass ceiling. Talk about the glass thing you had, you know the expression?
Yeah.
When you hit the glass ceiling, okay? This is the ultimate glass ceiling. You've gone through every, you've broke down every level of mechitza, and you've reached that top, and you bang your head against the clear pane of glass. That ke'ilu is what Moshe Rabbeinu did. For who are seichel enoshi habilti nivdal. And this is the limitations of the human intellect while he's still in the body. What this is saying, though, you asked about Moshe Rabbeinu before, is that Moshe Rabbeinu was able, through his own work, through his own midas, through his own self-development, this didn't get dropped in his head. He did this by his own hard work, and then he reached a level whereby he was able to connect with God. And if you look at Moshe's early life, it's a lot about his ethical development. He's kind. He goes out to help people. He's always, everything he's doing, he's helping people. He's ethical. He's moral, and he has standards, and he has principles, and the like. And then eventually he gets to the burning bush, and he's given slowly an awareness of God, and he builds that. That's the Moshe Rabbeinu. But the Moshe Rabbeinu we've been painted here is a Moshe Rabbeinu of being a self-made man. He isn't just plopped in his head. So Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't just kind of created. God didn't create him to be able to do this, because the seventh ikkah has to be something you acquire yourself. Even normal prophecy, to some degree, you have to acquire yourself, and then God has to make the connection. But this Kal Vachomer, you know, there's a fascinating midrash, and there's a question as to whether it's authentic or not, but it's quoted at the end of the Tiferes Yisrael in Kiddushin. The Tiferes Yisrael is a commentary on the Mishnah, okay, from the 18th century. And he wrote this commentary, and he includes at the end of Kiddushin a section about Moshe Rabbeinu, which, if you pick a standard copy of the Tiferes Yisrael off the shelf, has been censored. And this one has not been censored by the church. This has been censored by us. Okay? And in some copies it's there, and in some copies it's not. Okay? It's a fairly unfortunate example of censorship. And in fact, when I read this first, I went to my copy and I looked, it just wasn't there. And there was nothing indicating that something would be taken out. And I went online and saw another version online, and it was there. What is that? It is a midrash about Moshe Rabbeinu. And I'll tell you the midrash because it's fascinating. It says that, and I haven't done a PhD on the authenticity or where it came from originally, but it's quoted by other people as well. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu, when he brought the children, obviously the midrash is not meant to be a factual account, that's clear. It's meant to be a midrashic approach. It says when Moshe Rabbeinu left Egypt with the children of Israel, with the Bnei Israel, so a king from somewhere else in the world heard about this, and said, I need to get a handle on this Moshe Rabbeinu man, he must be incredible. So he sent a painter to paint Moshe Rabbeinu. The painter goes and paints Moshe Rabbeinu, and comes back with a painting of Moshe Rabbeinu. And the king shows it to his wise men in his country, and he says, tell me from the painting, what is this person like? And they looked at it and they said, look, you know, this painting, if it's accurate, is terrible. This person is like evil and greedy and money grabbing and angry and cruel and tithedic and all of these things. And the king was very upset and said, look, something's not right here. Either Moshe Rabbeinu is not the person who I've heard he is, or this painting is not a good representation of Moshe Rabbeinu, or you guys are telling me a load of rubbish. Either way, something's really gone wrong here. And everyone got very frightened and the other. And the story ends that the king went to Moshe Rabbeinu, he made his way there, and he saw him, he saw the picture, and he's looking at him, and indeed the picture is just like Moshe Rabbeinu. So he says, well, you know, what's going on? Because my people are telling me that this picture is of an evil, crooked, you know, man. Are they wrong? And Moshe Rabbeinu tells him, no, you're right. When I was born naturally with certain genetic, we would say today genetics, and inclinations to lots of very bad character traits. By nature and by upbringing, let's face it, he was brought up in a pretty nasty place. He was brought up in Paro's palace. It wasn't the best upbringing you can imagine. It's a dog-eat-dog world, and it's licentiousness and sexual immorality and the whole thing. It says everything about me lent in that direction. But you know something? One by one, I knocked down these barriers. We can fit it into the Rambam. One by one, I built my midas, and I developed myself until eventually I became the Moshe Rabbeinu that I am, but that was because I worked really hard on it. Now, you can understand why people censored this. Because, God forbid, you should think about Moshe Rabbeinu as some. On the other hand, maybe that's exactly the point. Maybe that's exactly the idea, that the whole point of the intellect of Moshe Rabbeinu was that it's something that he worked incredibly hard on. It wasn't just plopped into his head. This, of course, is a big machlokas today as to whether you're allowed to say anything negative about other people which inspires you to be like them at the same time as painting them in a less than glorious light. About 15 years ago, there was a book written by a very chosh of a Talmud Chacham called The Making of a God. Okay? You could ask Rabbi Shurin about it, because the author of the book is Rabbi Shurin's uncle. Okay. The Making of Godel was a book about Gedolei Yisrael, who were no longer alive, from the 19th century and the early 20th century. It was a book about his grandfather, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. Okay. And it was about how many, and it gave stories about how many of these great people had difficult, rocky parts of their lives. There were times when they were dealing with issues that were, they were in a bad place, let's put it that way, and they got themselves out of that bad place, and they got past it. And the book was banned So chas v'chalili, you can't say that about the Gedolim, you can't say that about people, because it's lashon hara, and people don't want to read about that kind of thing, and it's not true, and yeah, yeah, yeah. And the author of Lawson said, no, look, that's the point. If I make up hagiography and stories about Gedolim that are just not true, but are they paint them like angels, so people were very impressed, but it has no impact on you. This is nothing like me. I can't relate to this. But if I write you the truth, which is that these people went through really hard places, they came out of it and became great gedolim, so you can also be a godel. They can be a godel, you can be a godel. It didn't go. It's not that bit. You can't get it now except for like $20,000 on eBay or something like that. I'm exaggerating. Or you can get hold of it from sneaky sources on electronic format if you know the right people to ask. Okay, I'm not going to tell you what. I'm going to tell you live on tape who are the right people to ask, okay? But the point is, this is reflective of this very interesting midrash, but it tells you a lot about this ikar of Moshe Rabbeinu, okay? Now, to finish, have just a look for a second at the eighth ikar, as an introduction to next time. Because the eighth ikar, which is Torah Min HaShamayim, look at number 12, is a whole different world. Hayesod HaShmini, Torah Min HaShamayim. The eighth ikkah, says the Rambam in Torah number 12, is Torah Min HaShamayim. We're going to see this again next time, please God. All the Torah that we have with us today, this was the Torah that was given over to Moshe. We'll talk more about that when we get into it. And that the entire Torah came from the mouth of the Gevurah. Who's the Gevurah? No. Mipia Gevurah is an expression that literally means from God's mouth. The Gevurah means the force. If any of you are Star Wars fans, okay? God is called by our sources, Catholic sources, the force. Okay? That doesn't mean it's what George Lucas thinks of force. Exactly. George Lucas may have departed on his own understanding of the force. But for Bipia Gevurah, in other words, the entire Torah comes from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Returning Lomo, what I mean by that is Shehigia Alav Kulam Eitz Hashem. The entire Torah came from God. In a way that we borrow a phrase we call speech. God spoke the Torah to Moshe. The lawyer the Eichel Zoyta Agar Elohu. We don't know exactly, only Moshe knows what that speech was like. We use the word speech, it's not really speech. Alav Hashem. Asher Yulav, how it came to him. Hushehu b'madrega sofer. Moshe was just a scribe. Shekairin loy. You read it out to him. But who kaisiv kula, and he just writes it down. Okay? Dibri Yamel, the Sipuram, Mitzvaseh, he wrote everything down just exactly as it was told to him. Kach Nikra, that's why he's called him a choikek, a lawgiver. Vein Hevdel Bein, and he brings it from Psukim that they're doing this pasuk and that. Who is this Moshe Rabbeinu that we meet in the eighth ikra? A conduit. Just a conduit. He's just pure transparency. There's nothing of Moshe Rabbeinu there. He's a scribe. The scribe is not meant to be writing what he thinks the person is saying. And you don't need someone with a world-class, all-time, all-star intellect to be a scribe. On the contrary, I would probably not want such a person to be a scribe, because I want the scribes, you're not paid to think. You're paid to write what I say. Yeah? You don't want people who think in positions where they're meant to do what they're told. As you'll find if you ever employ them. Okay? The point here is, how does this compare with the seventh ikar? Which is, Moshe is the greatest brain, everything's about the brain and the intellect, that Moshe thinks about everything. The answer is, different kinds of Torah. The Torah, which is Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah which came to us, came through Moshe Rabbeinu. His job was to write it down, produce it. It's not coming, it's not Moshe Rabbeinu's own words. It's like HaKadosh Baruch Hu's words. We'll talk about Sefer Dvorim separately, okay? But the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral law, so that's coming to a very large degree through the intellect of the human brain, through the rabbis, through the development of Torah law, oral law. So you see the two different roles that Moshe's playing. Moshe's wearing, on the one hand, an intellect hat, and on the other hand, he's wearing just a scribe hat. And he's giving over what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said. That's why my understanding, the way I've been taught, is that the seventh and the eighth ikkar are not really the same thing. People often learn them together. The seventh ikkar, you have to know how great Moshe was to know that Torah Min HaShamayim is real. And I'm suggesting to you, no, that's not the case at all. The seventh secret is talking about the intellectual process of thinking, of understanding Torah, the reason behind Torah creation, etc. Torah Shabbat Peh. And the eighth ikkar is talking about the process of just giving over the exact wording of the Torah, which is Torah Shabbat Peh. The Torah Shabbat Peh. The written Torah. Okay? Two different kinds of Torah, two different kinds of ikkarim, and the two are interrelated, obviously, but they are separate. Yes, Katie?
Did Moshe understand the reason behind all the hoax?
Yes, 100%. Even Shlomo HaMelech says he understood every chayik, apart from one, Parah Adumah. Parah Adumah, you know, stumped him. But every other chayik, the human beings have understood every other chayik.
Why would he give those over?
Who said he didn't? Who said he didn't? Who said we don't know the reasons behind chukim? Maybe they're not 100% the reasons behind, but chukim are not completely, undecipherable.
Okay.
Yes.
How come Moshe wasn't one of the 10 people who didn't die with their body or fishing line?
I don't know. What does that mean? You have to learn midrashically what that means when it says they didn't die and their soul went up to Shammai. We see Eliyahu HaNavi in the Psukim goes up to Shammai, but it doesn't say that he died. Most of the other cases that you're referring to are people that the Midrash says that such a person didn't die. You have to understand, in each case, what does that mean? Does that mean they really physically didn't die, or it means that they died but they live on in some way, etc.? It says that Yaakov Avinu lo mes. It says Yaakov never died. Well, I mean, somebody embalmed him. So on a physical level, I hope that he did. Okay? It doesn't mean that Yaakov Avinu didn't physically die. It means that there's something about Yaakov Avinu which is nitzchi, which is eternal, which is unkillable, which can never be. So every case has to be looked at the drastic thing, saying, why is that not case of Moshe Rabbeinu? I'm not sure exactly, but Moshe Rabbeinu, the Torah goes at great lengths to stress that Moshe Rabbeinu was a physical human being who lived and he died, because there's a very strong danger of us turning Moshe Rabbeinu into a Avodah Zorah. That's one of the reasons why we don't know where he's buried, and we can't turn him into some conduit for us to get to God. Yes?
Just a sort of similar, sort of different question. If he was on such a high level, did so many great things, then why didn't he get to go into Eretz Israel and all of these great things?
Oh, okay. Okay, fine. So because Moshe Rabbeinu had freedom of choice at the end of the day, and Moshe Rabbeinu made certain mistakes in certain areas. And we'll see, not in the area of Torah, we'll see how that works and certain things. If you learn Chumash, the Mephoreshim are at pains to try and understand what exactly is the reason that Moshe has refused to enter to Eretz Yisrael. Is it because of Mei Meriva? Is it because of the rock and that he hit the water, the rock, and he didn't speak at the rock? Is it, and if so, what was that Aveira? Is it something earlier, it was a slab, where he turns around and he says that you couldn't possibly give enough meat to feed the Jewish people? Maybe that's where he lost it. Is it even earlier in the burning bush where he says, I don't want to go? Each of them have to understand each reason in and of itself. Nobody ever said Moshe was a perfect individual. Moshe had perfected himself to the highest level that human beings can perfect themselves, but even that is imperfect and mortal.
He was so much higher than everyone who does get to God.
Nachon. Okay, fine. So, but you could ask that: why do we merit to sit in Eretz Yisrael, and yet our great-great-grandparents, who are unquestionably on a higher level than us in many ways, never made it? Why did the Vilna Gaon never make it to Eretz Israel and you and I are sitting here? I can ask that question. All I can say to that question is, if we are sitting here, there must be a good reason that we're sitting here. So let's make sure that we do it right. Okay? With that point, we'll finish. Okay.